Professor Markson, I've gotten a Skype call from Gene. He said that he's not able to log in, and that because the class is showing it's closed.
Okay, you are now being archived, and I had the same message that the class was closed. He's probably logging in on the wrong area. There were two areas. You can log in as a guest or just enter the room. One needs to enter the room in order to be able to get into this active class. If you try and go in as a guest, you won't be able to get in. It shows you like the class is closed.
I'll call him back on Skype and tell him that.
Thanks. Okay, Marshall, we're pretty much ready to go whenever you are.
Okay, I think it says archive started now. So, okay. I know that some of you are new to the area of tax treaties and the like, and I guess I should have a picture on here if I can. Yeah, okay. I seem to have two pictures on here, but I guess that'll work. Anyway, some of you are new to the area of tax treaties and other forms of tax agreements. So let me start with a few basics. We've had various types of income tax treaties in force around the world for probably about 100 years now. Some of them started in Europe way back. And the United States, for example, was a party to many of them for many years. And in about late 1970s or around 1980 or 81, the United States was unhappy about the fact that some extensions of tax treaties to British overseas territories and Dutch overseas territories were supposedly being abused by people to get income coming from the United States at very low rates of tax that they felt were not proper under the circumstances. One of the best examples of that was a treaty between the United States and the Netherlands Antilles, which was widely used, especially by people from Latin America. Similarly, there were extensions of an old UK-US treaty that were widely used, but not quite as widely as the Dutch treaties, by people investing in the United States. And frequently, they would be able to get what should be taxed as interest at either a zero rate or a very low rate, as let's say 5%, without being subject to much, if any, tax in the overseas UK or Dutch territory. Similarly, they were getting dividends out at typically a 15% rate. There was some thinking on the part of the U.S. Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service at that time that they should do away with some of these treaties. And in the early 1980s, they did away with some of these treaties. They simply canceled them. And they decided on the recommendation of a man named Richard Gordon, who was a special assistant to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue and to the Treasury Department, that they should substitute for those places, such as the overseas British and Dutch territories, a tax information exchange agreement. We call these TIEA. It's an acronym for Tax Information Exchange Agreement. Now, what is a Tax Information Exchange Agreement? It's an agreement that provides for exchange of information between the two countries. Typically, it provides, let's say the two countries are the Netherlands Antilles and the United States. It provides that the United States is required to give information to the Netherlands Antilles, and it typically may provide also that it's a mutual arrangement so that the Netherlands Antilles would have to give information to the United States. In many of these cases, these are actually one-sided agreements rather than two, even though they may say they're two-sided agreements. For example, there is a TIEA between the United States and the Cayman Islands, and the Cayman Islands has no particular reason why it would ever really want information from the United States, but the United States may want a lot of information from the Cayman Islands. Now, during the period of the 1980s and 1990s, the United States signed a number of these TIEAs, mostly with small Caribbean countries, but also with a few other places. The agreements, there were very, very few TIEAs at that time involving countries other than the United States. But in about the year 1998 or 1999, the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, decided that it was time to get these types of TIEAs all over the world. And they did, they attacked some of the smaller tax havens at that time. And eventually, it took them almost 10 years, but eventually this got to the point where all of them agreed that they would cooperate by signing TIEAs or the equivalent. About 5 years ago, the OECD decided that the typical way in which countries, the big countries, were receiving information wasn't sufficient, and they amended at that time the model OECD income tax treaty to broaden it to include a few new requirements. The two basic new requirements were that a country would be required to get information and give it to the other country that was asking for it, even though it had no use for that information itself. And the other one was basically a penetration of bank secrecy, so that even though there might be some bank secrecy legislation or court decisions requiring bank secrecy, that those would not apply in the case of requests for information under the tax treaty or the TIEA. At about the same time, the OECD issued a model TIEA, which is closely followed today by most countries. Most of the real activity in this area involving many countries has been very recent, however. That is in 2009 and 2010. I want to call your attention to a report that appears on the OECD website. If you go to the OECD and put in OECD and tax, you'll find a paper, the latest version of which is dated the 3rd of September, just 2 weeks ago, and there'll be a new one, I'm sure, before the end of this month. And the paper is entitled Promoting Transparency and Exchange of Information for Tax Purposes. And at the end of that paper, there is a table which shows which countries are good and which countries are bad. And what there is essentially there is a white list, a gray list, and a black list. As of this moment, there is nobody on the black list, although that may change during the coming year. There are still a few countries left on the gray list, but the vast majority of countries have, or territories, have been moved to the white list. And what enabled them to be moved to the white list? They have signed at least 12 TIEAs, or tax treaties with similar provisions. And they will be given a reasonable amount of time to put those agreements into force. Now, one thing that I need to point out is that under U.S. law, a TIEA is an executive agreement rather than a tax treaty. In almost every other country, it is equivalent to a tax treaty and must go through the ratification process for any other type of treaty. In the United States, you don't have that because there is legislation going back all the way to 1984, which says that the Treasury is authorized to sign TIEAs that meet certain standards. And if they do so, there is no need for the U.S. Senate to get involved in the ratification process, as it would have to do for a full tax treaty or any other type of treaty. So we sit today with a group of countries, and although the U.S. was heavily involved in doing TIEAs in the 80s and 90s, it has done a few more in the period between 2000 and 2010, but the vast majority of activity that has taken place in the world involves TIEAs being signed by practically every country in the world, and there's a large group of them that have signed these agreements, and the latest figure I've seen is something like 540 such agreements already in force. And I would expect that within the next couple of years, we will end up with over 1,000 of them all over the world. Today, I want to talk about one specific agreement. On its face, it's very similar to many of the others, but there's some interesting aspects of it. It was signed just 2 years ago during 2008. It was signed by the United States with the government of Liechtenstein, the Principality of Liechtenstein. And it was actually signed on December 8th of 2008. It entered into force in December of 2009, but was effective and is effective for matters after January 1st, 2009. Now, the main reason I want to talk about the TIEA with Liechtenstein is because not only is it a typical tax information exchange agreement under which the United States can now get information from Liechtenstein that it should never have been able to get in the past, but I see it as a means of the IRS, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, being able to get information in many cases from Switzerland that it might not be able to get under its past or possibly even the new agreements with Switzerland. For that reason, I have marked up certain items in the TIEA that you should all have copies of. Turn now to Article 1, and it's pretty standard of TIEAs, and I want you to note that the words foreseeably relevant are now in there, so that, for example, Liechtenstein must provide information to the United States that is foreseeably relevant to the administration and enforcement of U.S. domestic law. Now, that's not unusual in some of the very recent agreements, but I noted because it was not, that language was not in there in some of the older TIEAs. So when you are looking at one of these, you need to look at that particular thing to see whether that language, which is much broader than the standards that obviously applied beforehand, are there. I come to Article 2, and here we have some interesting language. Information shall be exchanged in accordance with this agreement by the competent authority of the requested party, that would be Liechtenstein in our case, without regard to whether the person to whom the information relates is, or whether the information is held by, a resident of a party. Now, I read that to mean that if there is, it doesn't matter whether the United States, for example, is asking for information about someone who is or is not a resident of the United States. They have the right to ask for that. It doesn't matter whether the information is relating to someone who is a resident of the United States. It doesn't matter whether the information is held by a resident of Liechtenstein. It says that, however, a requested party is not obligated to provide information which is neither held by its authorities nor in the possession or control of persons who are within its territorial jurisdiction. I suggest to you that this is a very important piece of language that may not be found in all of TIEAs, but is in this one. And why is it important? Well, now we have to go back a little bit into history of how Liechtenstein has been used for the past 50 years or so. There is a very close relationship between Liechtenstein and Switzerland. And I could say, I think pretty safely, that if someone who was looking to hide things in Switzerland went to his Swiss bank or her Swiss bank 20, 30, 40 years ago, they would have been told, well, yes, you can open an account in Switzerland and it'll be a secret numbered account and nobody will have any information for it. But for extra privacy and for extra security, we suggest that you go to our friends in Liechtenstein and that you set up an entity in Liechtenstein and use it to open the bank account in the United States. As a result, at least many Europeans and many others over the past 20, 30, 40 years have used two types of entities primarily, but others as well, that were formed in Liechtenstein to get a double layer of security. One, the Swiss wouldn't give any information, at least then, and Liechtenstein wouldn't give any information, at least then, and they would have this double protection. Now, what are those two entities? There are two types of entities. There's the Anstalt, or establishment, that is formed in Liechtenstein, and there is the Stiftung, or foundation, formed in Liechtenstein. I call your attention to the fact that under Liechtenstein law, the persons running an Anstalt or Stiftung, if there, no matter how many there are, at least one of them must be a resident of Liechtenstein. So what you have is a situation where if somebody formed an Anstalt or a Stiftung in Liechtenstein, let's say back in the 1980s or 1990s, that person, if they went to open a bank account in Switzerland, they would have a Swiss bank account, but it wouldn't be in the individual's name. It would be in the name of that entity, the Anstalt or the Stiftung. And there would be somebody in Liechtenstein who would be in possession or control of persons, of a person who was in the territorial jurisdiction. I think that this, in effect, gives a backdoor way of the IRS and I know some of you are from the IRS, but I mentioned this anyway, to get information not only from Liechtenstein, but also perhaps in many cases from Switzerland. And of course, the idea that this was double secrecy, that was then, and this is now. We're in a new era today. I know some of you may have some questions as I go along, but I would like to conclude. I would like to take a total of about 40 or 50 minutes and just go through this whole thing with you, and then I'll open up for questions. We'll have plenty of time because you're required to do something at about 12 o'clock East Coast time, 9 o'clock Pacific time, and we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards. Now, if we look at Article 3, we can gloss over the fact that the agreement covers any kind of U.S. tax. So it wouldn't be limited to income tax. It would also cover federal estate tax or gift tax, for example. If we go down further, we find that there's some mention of criminal tax matters. And you see that the definitions include criminal tax matters means tax matters involving intentional conduct which is liable to prosecution under the criminal laws of the requesting party. I've teased some people in the past and said that that would be broad enough to cover everything in the United States except jaywalking. Criminal laws means all criminal laws designed as such under domestic law, irrespective of whether contained in the tax laws, the criminal code, or other statutes. All very broad language. The United States includes not only the United States, but it also would include, for example, places such as Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, Guam, and other U.S. Possessions and territories. That's significant because that is the policy for the United States with respect to its TIEAs, but it has exactly the opposite policy with respect to all of its regular tax treaties. There, those places are almost always excluded. We go to subparagraph 3 of Article 5, and there we're talking about what types of information are exchanged, and typically the TIEA deals with the exchange of information upon request. Some tax treaties are broader than that and would require different types of exchange that could be involved, but TIEAs typically only cover information on request. There's no requirement, for example, that Liechtenstein just send blanket information to the United States. So information shall be obtained and exchanged under this agreement without regard to whether the requested party needs such information for its own tax purposes or whether the conduct being investigated would constitute a crime under the laws of Liechtenstein, in our example, if it had occurred in the territory of Liechtenstein. So if something is a crime under a tax crime, for example, under U.S. law, that's good enough, even though it may not be a similar crime if somebody did the same thing in Liechtenstein. Liechtenstein may not need the information for its own purposes, and that's immaterial. If the information in the possession of the competent authority of the requested party, Liechtenstein, is not sufficient to enable it to comply with the request for information, Liechtenstein would have to take all relevant information gathering measures to provide the requesting party with the information requested, notwithstanding that Liechtenstein may not at that time need some information for its own tax purposes. Privileges under laws and practices of the United States shall not apply in the execution of a request by the United States, and such matters shall be reserved for resolution by the United States. Coming down further, each party shall ensure that it has the authority to obtain and provide through its competent authority and upon request information held by banks, other financial institutions, and any person, including nominees and trustees, acting in an agency or fiduciary capacity. Must also confirm that that in the case of partnerships, information regarding the ownership of companies and other legal entities, and in the case of partnerships, information regarding the identities and members of the partnership. And in the case of trusts, information on the settlors, trustees, and beneficiaries. In the case of foundations, that's the Stiftung, information on the founders, members of the foundation council, and the beneficiaries. So that all of that type of information must be provided upon request. If we skip down further, we find in Article 7, Paragraph 5, the expiration of a statute of limitations for taxes of the United States shall not preclude Liechtenstein from obtaining and providing the requested information. So that even if the Liechtenstein had a shorter statute of limitations than the United States, it would still have to give the information. I urge you to read the entire agreements, incidentally. I'm only covering certain highlights to call your attention to them, but you should be familiar with the language in these things. Now, it was agreed that any legislation that was necessary would be enacted by the end of December 2009, and this was done. It also says in that there's an appendix that constitutes an integral part of the agreement. And then it says, upon entry into force, it shall have effect for requests made on or after the date of entry into force with regard to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009, which means that unlike some TIAs, which go back indefinitely, this one is limited to giving information for, right now, the years 2009 and 2010. If the IRS was trying to get information, generally speaking, under this agreement, for years prior to 2009, let's assume they suspect somebody signed an account, bank account and had it for many years, either in Liechtenstein or in Switzerland, that it was opened by an Anstalt or Stiftung, and that they believe that the Anstalt or Stiftung was owned by or controlled by or for the benefit of somebody who was a U.S. person. They can get information as to 2009 and 2010, but they can't get basic information for years prior to 2009. Now let's skip over to the appendix and see how that helps or changes that situation. You get in the appendix something that says, under the definitions, that the term person also includes foundations, that is the Stiftungen and Anstalten, which are the establishments. So these are clearly covered and very definitely were intended to be covered. Coming down further, I think we come to what may be the most important provision in the entire agreement and the appendix combined. This is paragraph 8 of the appendix. It says, although the agreement allows only for requests for information with regard to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009, The agreement provides for exchange of documents or information created in or derived from a date preceding January 1, 2009 that are foreseeably relevant to a request relating to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009. Such information may be used only if there is an ongoing investigation or examination with respect to a tax year that begins on or after January 1, 2009. For example, if assistance is requested with respect to a taxpayer's bank transactions occurring after December 31, 2008, and documents such as, but not limited to, a signature card for the account in question were executed prior to January 1, 2009, the parties would exchange the documents. Now, what happens? Remember, I told you that this agreement was signed on December 8, 2008. Nobody really paid much attention to it at the time because most people didn't even see it until sometime in 2009. So if our friend, mythical friend, had an Anstalt or Stiftung that ran his account in Liechtenstein or Switzerland, and the information was there, the account would still have been in existence after January 1st, 2009. It would have been almost impossible for these accounts to have been closed in 2008. Or earlier, for somebody who suddenly realized that the protection he was expecting might be gone. So remember, this thing is effective for 2009 and 2010 and all future years, but that the bank records can be obtained, including the account opening form. Now, suppose we come back to the idea that Mr. X created his Anstalt in Liechtenstein back in, 1996. Now the IRS investigates him for 2009 and 2010, and they can only get information from Liechtenstein under the TIEA for 2009 tax information for 2009 and 2010, but they asked for the bank for the signature card, and the signature card shows it was signed in 1996. Now, that opens up the door to an investigation under a different agreement, which we will talk about now. And that is the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty between the United States and Liechtenstein. Let's talk about that one for a minute. There is a treaty with Liechtenstein on mutual legal assistance in criminal matters. It was signed in July of 2002, July 8th of 2002. The document as submitted to the United States Senate for ratification was sent as Treaty Document 107-16, and it was it entered into force August 1st of 2003. Now, here I'm not going to go through the agreement itself, although I suggest that you read it in its entirety, because it is similar to many other mutual legal assistance treaties. We call these MLATs for short, M-L-A-T, MLAT. And for this I think the best way of understanding what we need to know concerning this particular treaty is to read then Secretary of State Colin Powell's letter of submittal that was part of this treaty document. And there I have highlighted some of the provisions there. Colin Powell pointed out that the treaty will enhance the ability of the United States to investigate and prosecute a variety of offenses, including tax offenses of particular interest to the United States law enforcement community. I call your attention to the fact that prior to September 11th of 2001, the idea that Liechtenstein would give information to anybody about anything was considered horrible. Because of the changes to the world in general as a result of the bombing of the attack on the World Trade Center in New York and other similar attacks on September 11th of 2001, the United States began to really go after getting MLATs with as many countries as possible. And although the alleged purpose of getting that information was to prevent terrorism and various similar types of activities, the United States, I am told by some Liechtenstein people, insisted that this MLAT, and maybe many others too, include provisions to deal with tax offenses. Whether that was with the idea that there may be tax offenses related to terrorism, or whether it's just used as an excuse to get tax information that they might not otherwise have been able to get, I leave to you to decide. But notice that right at the outset, Colin Powell says, the treaty will enhance our ability to investigate and prosecute a variety of offenses, including tax offenses of particular interest to the United States law enforcement community. Now, one of the major differences between an MLAT and a TIEA is that an MLAT doesn't permit the IRS to ask for information from Liechtenstein. The information would have to be requested by the U.S. Department of Justice, that is, the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. So it isn't as convenient for the IRS to use this as it would be for them to use a TIEA. And if they had their choice, they would certainly have preferred that the TIEA not have the provision limiting it to years beginning on or after January 1st, 2009. What we have is a situation where we say Mr. X may have created his Anstalt in the year 1996. At least that's what the signature card may show. He hasn't reported anything, and the IRS gets information showing that he has an account in 2009 and 2010. Now the IRS goes to Mr. X and says, we know you have this account for the years 2009 and 2010. When did you create this account, and where are the records for the prior years? One of two things can happen. Mr. X can give that information, or he can try to hide it. If he tries to hide it, the second recourse is to go to the MLAT and say, this is a criminal tax case, therefore we can use this mutual legal assistance treaty And now we go further into the language as summarized by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Article 1.3 states that assistance is to be provided without regard to whether the conduct involved would constitute an offense under the laws of Liechtenstein. Article 1.4 provides that with respect to offenses concerning taxation, the requested state, that's Liechtenstein, shall provide assistance where the conduct described constitutes tax fraud, defined as tax evasion committed by means of the intentional use of false, falsified, or incorrect business records or other documents, provided the tax due either as an absolute amount or in relation to an annual amount due is substantial. This paragraph also provides that the requested state shall not refuse assistance because its law does not impose the same kind of tax or does not contain the same kind of tax regulations as the law of the requesting state, the United States. That definition is kind of elaborated on, and I must tell you that having looked further down, I believe you will find that if there are misstatements or omissions or anything of the type in a tax return filed by a corporation that is an 1120 or a tax return filed by an individual which contains a Schedule C showing business activities, that for sure would be covered. I'm not going to read some of the rest of this stuff, but you'll find here some very broad language showing that the definition of what would be covered here as so-called tax fraud by Liechtenstein standards is somewhat different than the standard that has typically been used in other agreements. You see further down, the exchange of notes also expresses the party's agreement that the term document includes specific tax forms used by a party to evidence the bookkeeping of a business, balance sheets and income and expense accounts, and specifically that U.S. Internal Revenue Service Form 1120 relating to corporate income tax returns and Schedule C of Form 1040 relating to profit or loss from sole proprietorships constitute such documents. During the course of negotiating, the U.S. delegation developed and presented to the delegation of Liechtenstein a series of hypothetical cases arising under U.S. tax law for which assistance from Liechtenstein should be provided. Based upon the replies provided by Liechtenstein, the U.S. government determined that Article 1.4 and the related exchange of notes established a sufficiently broad scope for coverage of criminal tax matters. Article 1.5 states explicitly that the treaty does not create a right on the part of any private person to obtain, suppress, or exclude any evidence or to impede the execution of a request. So really what I am suggesting to you here is that if someone did use an Anstalt or Stiftung to open an account in Switzerland and has not come to the IRS to disclose this under various things and has not, that the likelihood is that this agreement or these agreements together are going to make it fairly easy for the IRS in due course to get those people, and that the days of secrecy are pretty much over, if they ever really existed. Years ago, I said that there really was no such thing as bank secrecy, and someone, because it was always somebody who would have the information. Which brings me to, I guess, what is called the CIA definition of bank secrecy. And that is, you have secrecy when two people know something and the other one is dead. I think with that, you get the picture that I'm trying to create here, and that is that there is a new world that we're living in, which includes a mess of TIEAs between countries, a mess of mutual legal assistance treaties between countries, a mess of tax treaties between countries that provide for exchange of information, and in some cases also for assistance in collecting taxes, and that the world is very different than it used to be or supposedly was in the past. I think at that point we can open this up for questions. Let me see if I can get turn this video off so that I can see the. Okay. Just a minute here. Some people were saying they were locked out. I don't know anything about that. A question is asked about who makes the determination of whether the requested information is foreseeably relevant. It looks to me like that is probably going to be argued by the requesting state, that is in the example I used, by the United States, who's going to say it's foreseeably relevant. There may be situations in which the other country may say that it's not, that it's a fishing expedition. But I think that what we find today is that countries such as Liechtenstein, which in the past used to heavily rely on bank secrecy, are now leaning over backwards to be cooperative. They don't want to be uncooperative. You will find that when you check the OECD website and get into the thing listing the list of countries that have now suddenly become very cooperative in order to be put on the white list, that they are pushing each other in an effort to get the necessary number of agreements. The OECD's global forum will be meeting later this month. The G10 will be meeting again between now and the end of the year. And we're going to see a movement to tighten things even further, insist on cooperation between countries, that everybody will fight to be taken off the potential blacklist because they are worried about the so-called countermeasures or sanctions that may be taken against any country that remains on the blacklist. I will have more to say about that in a lecture that I will be giving in a month or so that I think all of you will be able to attend. It deals with whitelists, blacklists, prey lists and the like, but I don't know exactly when that will be given. I see something here as per subparagraph 3 of Article 5, and I can't find anything after that. Being asked by Edgardo Santiago. I'm sorry. Refers to my previous comment that was, wait a minute. When dealing with the unavailable information, what would be the challenge? Well, the question is there any information that is really unavailable? I guess that's the question, because if the Stiftungsrat of a Stiftung is sitting in Liechtenstein, as it has to be, why is the information unavailable? It certainly should know about any bank accounts that's opened by the Stiftung anyplace, and it certainly should be able to get the information, and that's all that seems to be necessary. So, well, I think the basic thing is that the IRS is supposed to ask for information itself first, but if it can't get it in any other means, I guess, for example, if the IRS had access to the information directly under a Swiss-U.S. treaty, it should be able to get it there. But if it can't get it there and it can't get it from somebody in the United States, then it will ask for it. At that point, it's not available by other means. I don't think you're going to see too many challenges in Liechtenstein itself. I think you may see some in Switzerland more than you would in Liechtenstein, and I think that's one of the reasons why the IRS will probably try to use this agreement. How are these affecting European insurance companies? First of all, there are other agreements. The policies in general will probably make it possible for the IRS and its counterparts in other countries to request information under tax treaties and TIAs, and if necessary, under MLATs affecting European insurance companies. I don't see any reason why not. Professor Markson asked, can these TIAs and MLATs be used as a backdoor of getting into info on Switzerland? I think in some cases, yes. I think that that's clearly what's going to be happening because of the nature of these Liechtenstein entities. I'm looking for the winking eye icon. Wait a minute now.
Look at your lower bar where you see the people.
I see people, yeah. I'm sorry?
I don't have any video.
Okay, well, okay. I had it before. When I had the video, I could not see the message board, so I had to turn it off. I guess I can't have both. I'm sorry. Let me try this again here. No.
But
do you see the W with the little red yellow dot at the very lower line?
I see something that says talk.
No,
yeah,
no.
There's a little Marshallless camera, but like a video camera icon.
Oh yeah, okay, I see that. Right.
Click on
yeah,
that,
so now,
and then you'll see a winking eye icon on the lower left of that window that opens up. If you click on that,
got
that
it.
Should open your webcam.
It has
there
opened the window, but now I can't see the message board. Wait a minute. Maybe I can make that smaller.
That's
just a minute.
Right.
That's all right. Yeah, now I have it. Okay, now I have both.
Okay,
okay.
Good.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, okay. I have a request here to repeat the difference between a TIEA and an MLAT. The TIEA is a tax agreement between the tax departments of two countries. So by delegation, the IRS, for example, can use a TIEA directly to ask for information from its treaty partner or TIEA partner. Whereas when you get to an MLAT, you're talking about a criminal tax, criminal agreement that deals with all kinds of crimes, of which tax crimes are simply one. And there you, the IRS has no authority to go to Liechtenstein or any other country under an MLAT and directly ask for information. So now it has to go to the tax division of the Department of Justice and get them sufficiently interested to want to take the case. At that point, if they are sufficiently interested, they will take the case and bring it. And then they make the request through the competent authorities under that agreement. So it's a little more complicated and is not going to be used in as many situations. Professor Burns says he's on a flight, but he can see me. Wait a minute now. Mohammed asks, will Switzerland be required to release information pertaining to non-resident of the U.S. also? It isn't so much that Switzerland is required to release information, because I think we're not getting into now today the agreement between the United States and Switzerland. There are some modifications to the existing tax treaty between the United States and Switzerland that are in the process of being approved and probably will take effect shortly. The old agreement between Switzerland and the United States, which is a full tax treaty, there was a very old one and an old one, or the current one. The current one dates back to about 1996, and it provides for information in cases involving tax fraud or the like. Tax fraud or the like is specifically defined under a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Switzerland, which spells out all of the details, gives 14 examples, as I recall, of what would constitute tax fraud and the like. Now, that's what the rules were until now. That's going to be broadened very significantly now. Switzerland will be giving information more than it ever did in the past. But what I'm suggesting to you concerning Liechtenstein is that where people have not gone directly to Switzerland and opened an account in their own name or in some other type of entity, but have followed the advice that they often got from Swiss bankers to get this double layer of protection by using a Liechtenstein entity such as an Anstalt or a Stiftung, they have made things worse, not better. Because if an account in Switzerland has been opened by someone in Liechtenstein who is acting as the head of the establishment or the person in charge of the foundation, that person is certainly entitled to get the information without even going to the government. They opened the bank account. They are the signing people on the bank account. They are the people who are entitled to get it, and Liechtenstein will tell them to go get it so that they can give it to the United States. So we're not going to be dealing at that point with the information being obtained via Switzerland. It'll be obtained via Liechtenstein under those circumstances.
Courageous.
I'm looking to see if there are any other questions. I see some comments by Dean Burns, but he's on a flight. Okay.
I need to ask you a follow-up question to the statement you just made.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm wondering. You said if information were requested, the information will be provided because the person is a signing party to the account.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Yeah, you said if a person requested information and the person were a signing party to the account, the information will be provided.
Yes.
Is it because the person is a representative of the business in that country?
Well, let's assume that Mr. X created an entity, whether it's an Anstalt or Stiftung or a company or a trust or anything else. Under Liechtenstein law, there will be somebody in Liechtenstein who will have the right to get information concerning all of the accounts. If that is the case, then, and I believe it is, then you will have somebody in Liechtenstein who can be asked to give the information. The U.S. will go to the Liechtenstein tax authorities and say, ask Herr Schmidt for the information concerning this entity. And if Herr Schmidt doesn't have it, tell him to go get it, because he has the authority. He is someone who is sitting in Liechtenstein who has the authority to get the information, even though the information may be coming from Switzerland. That's the way I read this thing anyway. Now, of course, I don't know of any active use of this yet, but I think that's what we're going to be seeing. Dave Britton is asking, would the TIA cover source income as well? I guess it does, because the answer is if it very specifically says at the outset of the TIEA that it doesn't matter whether someone's a resident or not of the U.S. So yes, they could ask for it.
Another follow-up question.
Someone suggesting, I'm sorry, that won't take long. before we see this kind of information exchange implemented and in use. Yeah, I think that's generally true. Are any Asian or Caribbean countries bucking the trend toward these agreements? A little bit. Let's talk about that. And actually, I'm going to skip both Asia and Caribbean because I don't know of any specific there. But I'll give you some examples, and I think we will be talking about that in another lecture that I will be giving later. I'm going to talk about some in a future lecture about the tax, some of the developed countries with active tax treaty programs. The best example I can give you of that is probably Panama, which at the moment is still graylisted by the OECD, but will soon have the necessary dozen agreements that satisfy the requirements of the OECD. And what it insists on is that it will not sign TIEAs. It doesn't like the idea of a TIEA, which is an agreement that essentially gives no benefits to the other state, but simply demands that they provide things. These agreements, generally speaking, the TIEA is an agreement that has been forced upon the countries with threats that they will be exposed to all kinds of draconian countermeasures if they fail to sign them. I made a speech a few years ago to a meeting of the STEP organization, the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners in London. At that time, I recommended that these smaller countries try to get at least some benefits in return for signing these agreements. There are a few countries that have followed through on that. Probably the most significant one may be the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man has said, yes, we will sign TIEAs, but we also want at least some limited tax treaties with some benefits. And if you check with the Isle of Man and some of their agreements, you will find with places like Australia, New Zealand, and others, you will find that they have gotten some benefits. They have gotten benefits in their agreements, for example, also with the Netherlands and some other countries. So they are getting some modest benefits. Unfortunately, the OECD model that is being pushed on most people to sign doesn't give any benefits worth talking about. The U.S. in its past history has given very few real benefits, although it allegedly gave three benefits, all of which have now disappeared. The situation is such most countries seem to be afraid to hold out. The best example that I know of a country that has been fighting this is, as I said, Panama. And here's what Panama did. Panama said that any country that blacklists Panama will be disqualified from with respect to all of its entities or controlled companies of any kind from participating in government projects in Panama. Now, we've got some major changes coming to the Panama Canal, and many countries, companies from all over the world are anxious to get a share of the contract for rebuilding or doing construction work on the Panama Canal. And if that country blacklists Panama, Panama has said, we will not permit any company from that country to participate As a result, Panama has succeeded in getting some agreements. At the present time, the OECD says Panama has only signed two or three of these qualified agreements. But Panama has actually negotiated many, many more. And in the course of the next 6 months or so, I would expect Panama to now have a sufficient number of satisfactory agreements to meet the standards of the OECD. They will provide for giving certain types of information, such as information that Panama itself does not need for its own purposes, or bank information. Therefore, they will meet the necessary standards of the OECD, but they will not be nearly as detailed or beneficial as a typical TIEA is to the requesting state. I'm seeing here some other questions. What happens if the representative is no longer with the entity? Will the entity be required to present another representative? Yes. In other words, my understanding, and I'm not a Liechtenstein lawyer, but my understanding from having talked to many of them over the years, is that you've got to have somebody from Liechtenstein who is running or has the power to run the organization in those types of entities. I guess they could change that law, but they're not likely to, because at the moment, Liechtenstein has gone from being probably one of the least cooperative countries in the world to being one of the most cooperative countries in the world. And I think that that they've just simply changed completely. And I think they're going to bend over backwards to be cooperative. Something about the canal here. There are already U.S. Marshals in Panama and an IRS office on the way. Well, okay. The canal is extremely important. The world trade, yes. What types of sanctions are threatened? Professor Markson asked, and I can only say that there have been rumors concerning what they will be. It's quite possible that the proposed sanctions will be released between now and the end of the year. Either at the meeting of the OECD Global Forum, which I think takes place next week, next week, I believe, or at the forthcoming meeting of the G20. One of the rumored possibilities is that a country that is blacklisted for failure to do any of the necessary stuff will be prohibited from using the U.S. dollar as its currency. Or using some other currencies, because it will be up to each country that does the blacklisting to decide what it's going to do. The OECD can only recommend sanctions, but there are all kinds of other sanctions that may come before we get to that stage. I'm looking here. The U.S. dollar is on the way out anyway, somebody suggests. Well, okay. I had read that they were considering blocking them from using the international banking system. Yes. Actually, I don't know that the OECD has the power to do much of anything other than to recommend that its members, which are somewhere between 30 and 35 of the largest countries in the world, will be suggested to them that they individually impose sanctions of various types, and the types of sanctions that they're going to recommend are supposed to be recommended shortly. So there's some comments about whether the U.S. dollar is on its way out or whether it'll be very strong. I leave that up to you. I don't know that that's a part of this lecture. What effect will the TIA between the U.S. and Liechtenstein has had on foreign investment in Liechtenstein? I don't know, because I think what happened is Liechtenstein is trying to say at this point that it doesn't welcome this type of business anymore. It's thrived on it for the last 50 or 60 years, but I am told that the Prince of Liechtenstein has decided that in order to protect his investments abroad, that he doesn't want any kind of blacklisting of those, and that therefore the country should bend over backwards to be cooperative. I think what they are trying to do now is to get business investment. I don't know that they'll be very successful in getting it, but that's the attitude is they want to do away with anybody who's hiding things through Liechtenstein. And yet the country for the last 50 or 60 years was based almost entirely on trying to generate that type of business. So there's going to be major changes there. Certainly, whether it'll minimize the amount of foreign investment they get or not, I don't know, but I suspect it will. I think we probably have to stop there because I think you have a mandatory setup with another mandatory program coming up in about 10 minutes. But if you have any further questions, I think if you pass them on either to me or to I will be traveling for most of the next several weeks. But if you can pass along your questions to Professor Erasmus or to Dean Burns, I will try to deal with them if I can while I'm away, and if not, when I get back. So I thank you all, and I'm sorry that we had a little trouble getting the video and everything going, but I think it worked out quite well in the end. And I thank you all for participating, and I'm turning off the archive now.
Archive recording.